Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey, and your moderator for today. Today is Sunday, May 25th, 2025. This year ID numbers for Friday, May 23rd are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,462. That's 22462. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,463. That's 22463. This morning, A Vision for You presents Obstacles to Recovery in OA and to the Recovery of OA. The Program of Recovery, the 12 steps, as outlined in the Big Book, the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, represent a process of spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive overeating. The Big Book was written as a set of directions for doing the 12 steps quickly and effectively. It's not a book of theory or philosophy. It offers a clear step-by-step approach for your recovery. It enables us to really and fully understand the twofold nature of our problem. It presents a clear practical solution to our problem, and it shows us how to implement that solution through the 12-step program of recovery it describes. Recovery is often described as a journey, one step at a time, one day at a time. But anyone who has walked the 12-step path knows it's not always a smooth road. It is at times filled with bumps, detours, and sometimes what feel like dead ends. Once in a while, it's beneficial to take a critical look at those difficulties and those obstacles which threaten our progress. Exploring these obstacles can actually strengthen our recovery, deepen our understanding of the program of recovery and ourselves, and bring us closer to the freedom we are all seeking. Joining us today to speak about obstacles to recovery in OA is Lori C., a recovered compulsive overeater from Winnipeg, Canada. Lori is a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, dedicated to service around the globe and to carrying the message of recovery. It's always a privilege and an honor to welcome Lori to the line. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you for having me. Should I go on?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, it's a privilege and honor to be on this call. I don't consider it much of a privilege or honor to have me because I have to do this regardless of whether anyone listens. You know, my recovery dates back to a little over 32 years ago when I was able to achieve the miracle that is guaranteed by the 12 steps that millions and millions of addicts with dozens and dozens of addictions have experienced, this miracle of neutrality, that once I abstain from that which I know I have to abstain from, and I work the steps, I'm no longer tempted to return to those things. I'm not in any way enticed. My mind is not insane. I don't give myself excuses to return. I just don't want them. I look at them and they're poison to me. And so when the Big Book says that the most important thing in our life is our connection with a higher power and not abstinence, that is what is natural to me because I don't want this stuff. So abstinence comes pretty intuitively to me. So what I want to talk about today is the obstacles that stand in the way of OA as a whole and to each individual in their journeys to recovery. Some of them are fundamental. Some of them just exist within our fellowship as phenomena, as things that occur. And I hope that my discussion of this does, in fact, as Leah suggested, assist people in thinking about their own relationship to OA and to the journey that all of us are under. The first obstacle, it seems to me, is that unless we weigh 500 pounds or we weigh 40 pounds, our addiction is not dramatic. Our addiction is not one that if we indulge in it, suddenly we will rush into traffic not knowing where we are, put ourselves in danger, gamble away our life savings or anything of that sort. We can safely restrict once or vomit up our what we have eaten once or eat more of what we know we shouldn't be eating on one day and not suddenly put our entire lives at risk. And that lack of drama in our lives, in our addiction, sometimes makes it very difficult to see how life or death our addiction is. And it gives us a sense of, well, I can, and it's aided and abetted, of course, by all the diets and all the various binge eating disorder clinics and the eating disorder clinics and the experts on diet, you know, what we put into our bodies and how we can be more healthy. It's made even more difficult because all these other ways of doing things give us the sense that there are, and the medications we can take now, give us a sense that somehow we can handle our addiction in a way that that other addicts cannot, because we see all around us the effects of addiction in the homelessness of people's lives, the isolation, their self-destructive behavior that becomes more and more obvious and leads them down the path of annihilation. But for most of us, our addiction is one that is a gradual deterioration of the body and often the mind. It is gradual in the sense that inch by inch, our lives are being taken away from us, our ability to move, our ability to interact with other people. We are more and more dependent upon others for the most basic things of life. We are racked with different kinds of pains and different kinds of immobilities and disabilities. But it happens over a longer period of time. And it's easy to isolate a month and say, well, this isn't going to be any worse if I do this or that. And so this lack of drama is, I think, one of the most important obstacles that we have to face. When we carry the message of recovery, we have to find ways of explaining that recovery that go to the heart of the addiction so that when people listen to us about our recovery, talk about our recovery, they understand the miracle. And when I say that, I have to tell my story in such a way that people say, boy, I've never experienced that before. That recovery is something I want. I often tell a story about how my wife, who's a very normal eater, believes she's addicted to chocolate because she needs one or two squares of chocolate a day. And maybe she is addicted to it, but that's like needing one cup of coffee a day in the morning and then that's it for the day. It may be an addiction, but it certainly isn't a dangerous one, medically or otherwise, compared to the 20 cups of coffee I used to need to get up in the morning and to continue through the whole day. So anyway, my wife will order, has ordered at times a dessert in a restaurant, and she'll bite into it and she'll say, oh God, it's the best chocolate cake I've ever had. It's just so wonderful. And eat only half of it and then say that she's full. And when I say, when I tell that story and I say the miracle of my recovery is that A, I don't want to eat the rest of it to see how good it is. B, I'm so glad for her that she enjoyed what she did have. And C, I'm not angry with her for not wanting, for not finishing it all up. But these were emotions I used to feel. And that story is indicative of the kind of recovery that I have. Now, I have to find a way, and that this is the second obstacle that we have in OA, I have to find a way to convey that miracle to people who don't suffer from the same issues that I suffer from, but have a common addiction in compulsive eating. We are Overeaters Anonymous, and yet we welcome in our group consciences that we even substitute the overeater for undereater or just eater. We have within our fellowship people who are restrictors, people who suffer from a tendency to binge eat and then to purge themselves, which I think is a very nice word for vomit for most of them. And I think sometimes it's good to use the word vomit rather than purge, just to emphasize the terrible thing that can do to people. So when we tell our stories, and most of us are overeaters, some of us are both overeaters and undereaters and or purgers, and some of us are only undereaters, restrictors. When we tell our stories, our need to explain the miracle has to be of recovery, to the miracle of recovery through the 12 steps to those who still suffer. We have to find a way to find analogies so that people who suffer from other similar but not the same eating problems can also identify and understand the miracle that is available to them, even though it's a different kind of miracle in some form than the miracle that I have had. And this is one of the reasons why I really embrace the Big Book's definition of the addict, because it is so simple and yet intuitively fits any person who has a similar problem to ours. That definition of not being able to stop once I've started and not being able to stop from starting, the vicious circle that condemns us to a life of misery. This vicious circle makes sense to any addict as long as they can identify that which causes them not to be able to stop once they've started. And there's the other obstacle. There's another obstacle. Each of us in OA has to figure out what it is that causes us not to be able to stop once we've started. This idea that the Big Book describes as an allergy of the body, this abnormal reaction to, to a substance or to a behavior. And I think it's important that the word allergy of the body is really not an intuitive word these days to discuss how we feel about our can't stop once we've started concept. I mean, the analogy in its generic sense, of course, it simply means an abnormal reaction to a substance. But the 12-step fellowships that exist these days, including OA, run the gamut and the spectrum between those who have single substances that cause singular kinds of reactions in the body, physical reactions in the body, to behaviors that cause singular reactions to what? To the body, to the mind? How do you describe that? Well, the only way to describe it is simply to say, I cannot stop once I've started. I get cravings of some kind which are so powerful that my mind, my conscious mind, cannot stop them. And the analogy, of course, is I can hold my eyes open for X number of seconds, but at a certain point, my body will say, I've got to blink, or I can hold my breath for a certain number of seconds. At a certain point, my body will say, I've got to breathe. But that analogy doesn't fit the gambler. Once the gambler starts to gamble, once the debtor starts to go into debt, once the Al-Anon member starts to enable, how do you translate that into the allergy of the body without somehow saying what's most important is not the word you use to describe it. It is the feeling that you cannot stop it once you've started. It is this whole sense that no matter how conscious you are of how dangerous it is that you're doing or that you're ingesting, you cannot stop it because somehow you want more. You know, I have an eating behavior that is one of my craving-inducing behaviors. That eating behavior is chewing all the time, keeping my mouth busy. Now, I don't know why I have it. Maybe there's something physical in my body. I know that my mother was always felt guilty because she was taught that I should be nursed once every 4 hours, and that if I cried after 2 hours, she should not nurse me. She should let me cry, because that was what the medical people said was the proper time for nursing. Stupid then, but that's what she was told, and that's what she did. And she always felt guilty because that guy used to cry. And I know that she always felt guilty that she was told that she had to stop nursing me earlier than I clearly wanted to stop when I was a baby. Now, I don't know what psychological effect that had on me or what physical effect it had on me. I don't even know if that was the cause of my getting these urges to chew and keep my mouth busy, this oral fixation that I have. No, it's so ingrained in me that it causes me cravings when I indulge in it. And so we have to find words that fit the situations that in the broad fellowship, a potential fellowship of OA, and not just take for granted that our problem is of one kind. So this spectrum that OA embraces, I mean, we're not Floweraholics Anonymous, we're not Sugarholics Anonymous, we're not Fataholics Anonymous, we're not Chocolateholics Anonymous, we're not Ice Cream Aholics Anonymous, whatever that fellowship might be. We're compulsive eaters. And even though we're Overeaters Anonymous, we embrace undereaters. And so one of the obstacles we have is trying to explain to any newcomer that it is an individual issue as to what it is that causes the problem of not being able to stop once we started. That's a really difficult thing. There is all the tendency in the world to assume that our problem is the same as their problem, that they should be abstaining from what we think we should be abstaining from. From what we know we should be abstaining from, that they should be abstaining from the same things. There is the common language that we use, compulsive overeating, not compulsive undereating. How does that make the restrictor feel when they come in the rooms? When I say, you know, my name is Lori and I have been fat and salt and fat and sugar free for 32 years, does that impart the sense that if anyone is a member of OA, it means that they too should be sugar-free, fat and sugar-free and fat and salt-free? Are the words we use such that we exclude people simply because we take for granted that we are everyone, every one of us is the same? This is a very difficult issue because most 12-step fellowships organize themselves around very, very similar behaviors, whereas OA is the umbrella fellowship. There are many other food fellowships among us, 12-step fellowships, which assume that there's one particular problem, which have plans of eating, which assume that they have to abstain from particular things, which have different specific problems that they deal with. But we are the only fellowship that embraces anyone. And that's a real obstacle, both to our ability to find out in ourselves what it is that we have to abstain from, and in the ability of OA to be able to grow, because we don't carry the message of you have to figure out what it is you have to abstain from on an individual basis. We don't spread that message. We assume that our situation should apply to their situation. And that's a real difficult thing, to try to figure out what it is that we have to abstain from. I could go on and on about that. Much of what I do when I sponsor is to make sure that the person I am sponsoring knows what and why they have to abstain, that they're not simply adopting a diet, someone else's diet, even a nutritionist's diet, that they know that the purpose of their plan of eating, however they arrive at their plan of eating, whether it spells out what they can eat or whether it spells out what they can't eat or whether it spells out what eating behaviors they can indulge in or what eating behaviors they can't indulge in, whether they weigh or they measure or they estimate or they just figure out how full they are, or whether they've had enough, that each person has to figure it out for themselves. And there's such a tendency within OA to project our own problems onto other people. And it's subtle, because it's not as if most people in the room don't have the same problem. Most of them do. Most of them are overeaters. Most of them probably should be abstaining from some of the same kinds of things that the others should be abstaining from. But that there are always people who will not fit that mold. And if we don't open the possibility, well, it's not the possibility, the reality, open to the reality that people are different, we run the grave risk of excluding people who should be included, and also, by the way, including people who should be excluded. And the reason I say that, latter, is that the problem is not only that we develop a plan of eating that sets out how we're going to abstain, but it's also that we fail at times to focus on the real problem that the Big Book first isolated. And that is that once we know what we have to abstain from, it becomes very clear that that is not our problem. Any sane human being would simply say, well, if this causes me a life or death addiction, then I should simply abstain from it. And any sane human being would abstain from it, would look at what they used to enjoy and say, well, I used to enjoy it, but boy, now that I know that it's deadly, I won't have it. And the Big Book spends a lot of space in talking about this problem of the obsession of the mind, of the problem with the mind that keeps saying, you can have some, you can indulge in this, it's okay. Yes, it's been bad for you in the past, but it's not going to be that bad now. Now, this is universal to all 12-step fellowships. This is the brilliance, this is why the directions for working the steps that are found in the Big Book are just as universally true for the compulsive eater and for the Al-Anon person and for the narcotic addict and for the nicotine addict and for the gambler. Because the whole solution offered by the 12 steps is to get rid of the mindset and the ability of the mind to persuade itself that it can have that which it must abstain from. So I'm not going to spend much time on that, because that's the whole study of the Big Book and the whole study of the 12 steps. But what I do want to point out is that if we do not know what we have to abstain from, then all the sanity in the world, all the working of the steps in the world are not going to work, because we'll still be indulging in that which we have to abstain from. So one of the biggest dangers in OA, one of the biggest obstacles in OA, is the lack of analysis of what it is that we have to abstain from, and the acknowledgement that each one of us is an individual and has to figure it out for themselves. Sure, that we can get advice. Sure, we can consult with a lot of people, both within OA and experts outside of OA in terms of what is appropriate nutrition. But if we don't know what it is that we have to abstain from, what combinations of ingredients or single substances or eating behaviors, one, the other, the, all of them, depending on who you are. For me, it's a combination. I've got some eating behaviors. I've got some ingredients. I've got some combinations of ingredients. I also have specific foods that don't contain those ingredients, all of which I have to abstain from. But I can eat things that other people in this room can't eat, and they can eat things that I can't eat. I can engage in eating behaviors that other people can't, and vice versa. Other people can engage in eating behaviors that I can't engage in. So I think it's one of the biggest obstacles that OA has, is conveying this sense that we are individuals and we have to figure out for ourselves as honestly as we can what it is that we have to abstain from. The third obstacle that I think is fundamental to OA is that for the vast majority of us, the addiction that we have makes us isolated, gives us low self-esteem, makes us feel as if we are, well, makes us full of shame and guilt, that we are people who have been beaten down, and that we were never on top, that we've always been beaten down. Unlike the alcoholics in the big book who rose to the top and then fell down to the bottom, most of us feel as if we've always been at the bottom in some way, shape, or form, and probably because of our shape and form, we feel as if we are the lowest of lows. You know, when the big book says we've never been a friend among friends, a worker among workers, a member of the family, we've always strived to be at the top of the heap or dive down below to hide. Most of us, and I'm not saying it's true for all of us, but most of us have always felt as if we're at the bottom of the heap. And no matter how much we tried to be at the top, we always felt low. This sense of isolation, because I mean, there's an isolation inherent in if everyone thinks you're wonderful and you know you're terrible, you are completely isolated. You feel as if no one really understands you. And for years, when I look back at the people I was attracted to, it was the people who didn't treat me well because they were the only ones smart enough to see behind my veneer of somehow I was in some way worthy. But I knew I wasn't worthy, and the only people then who deserved me were people who knew how lousy I was. So I was attracted to people who treated me like dirt, which was pretty sick, but that was very true. So this sense of isolation, shame, and guilt, well, it does a whole bunch of things that prove to be an obstacle in no way. First of all, it makes it very hard for us to reach out and to sponsor. It makes this sense that we're not worthy continues to permeate us, even though we work the steps, even though we say, oh, yes, I'm learning how to live according to my higher power, according to my deepest beliefs. We still don't feel as if we are worthy of sponsoring. And the lack of sponsoring that really is a problem in OA. Excuse me. And I'll get back to that theme in a little while. there are many other obstacles. They're not as fundamental, but there are many, many other obstacles to the growth of OA and to the recovery of each one of us. One of them is that rightly, correctly, many of us feel as if we have been victims in our lives as opposed to victims. We read the big book, and it is about people. It was written by and is about people who did bad things in their lives to other people. It is pretty clear when they go through the things that they have done in their lives, the lying, cheating, stealing, the terrible abuse that they've inflicted on other people, it is pretty obvious to those who are described in the big book. I'm not saying this is true of members of AA in general, but certainly the writers of the big book. It is very hard to analogize from that to a person who's been beaten down in their lives, who has sometimes literally been beaten. It's difficult to imagine how the steps as described in a book like the Big Book, and even in our own literature, to understand how we have harmed others when we've been the recipients of harm, when people have done harm to us. You know, how many people have looked at the Big Book who come into OA and say, "You use that. Now, I'm not the one who should be reading it. He should be reading it," meaning their ex-significant other, or maybe their current significant other. And this whole sense that we are different, that we're the downtrodden, makes it difficult within OA to concentrate on the kind of harm we have indeed inflicted upon others. Now, that because that harm is sometimes much more subtle than it is to the person who knows that they have done harm to others, who knows instinctively that their manner of living has inflicted great harm on others. So it makes it hard to imagine, well, I'll never apologize to that man, you know, to imagine what you would do in steps 8 and 9 if, in fact, you've been badly treated. I say that man, that person. If you've been badly treated by another person and you're told that you have to make amends and that the kind of amends that can be made are apologies. Well, what kind of apologies do you make to someone who has treated you like dirt? And it's very hard not to sort of go forward and look at steps 8 and 9 and try to imagine that when you're doing step 4. The Big Book uses the word, when it discusses our defects of character, it uses the word selfish to describe self-will. Self-will is just wanting to be in charge of life, regardless of your motivations. Selfish in the dictionary clearly means wanting things to go your way for your own sake, for your own good, not for anyone else's good. Selfish has a bad connotation. Self-will is much more understandable. It's much more understandable for me to say, I think it's wrong for these bad things to have been done to me, for that person to have done bad things to me. It's not selfish to say that in any dictionary definition. So this whole sense that we have been victims and not victimizers, it's very difficult to understand selfish. It's very difficult to understand the word forgiveness. It's very difficult to understand the words amend. You often hear people saying, oh, the first person I owe amends to is myself. And that's quite understandable in the sense that people have to get rid of the shame and the guilt they may feel for having been treated badly in their lives, and maybe shame and guilt for accepting that treatment for longer than they should have, much longer than they should have. But it's hard to understand how that can be translated into a defect of character, and also how that can be translated into what kind of amends do I owe. These are very difficult and complex issues for many of us in this fellowship, even though for so many people in other fellowships, it's obvious what they have to do. You know, we have a friend who is a crystal meth addict and has had a great deal of difficulties in dealing with that addiction, great difficulties. And that person knows what amends he owes. He has expressed it. He owes living amends. He owes a crystal meth-free life to us. That's what he owes us. He owes us a sense that we don't have to worry about him, that he's not going to die on the streets of the very cold part of the world I live in. These are clear amends. You know, an apology is nothing. It's a living amends that are owed to us. But it's much more difficult to understand an amends that consists of, I have withheld my trust of you because of things that happened to me when I was a child, and therefore the amends I owe are being more loving or being more open to rejection or something of that sort. That's a more subtle form of amends. Or an amends might be, I will stand up for myself. I will stand up for what's right. I will say the truth when the truth has to be told. I will say it in a way that it can be heard with compassion and love, but I will say the truth. And this just doesn't, it's hard to translate that kind of amends into the language of, I'm really sorry for what I have done, and I'm going to live my life better now. It's hard to do that. So the subtleties that sometimes have to be done in our program to figure out what amends do we owe are really, really hard, and whether we owe them and whether we should make them. Another obstacle in OA, and it's a big one, I think, is that there are very entrenched ideas in OA that can contribute both to lack of recovery and to relapse. One of them I've alluded to, and that is this sense that my plan of eating should be the same as your plan of eating should be the same as my plan of eating. Sponsors who go around saying, I can't sponsor you unless you adopt this plan of eating. This sense that what is right for me has to be right for you. That is first of all, it's contrary to the group conscience of OA. World Service Business Conference has clearly expressed through the literature, a new plan of eating, through our OA 12 and 12, that each one of us has to figure out what we have to abstain from and in what way we're going to abstain from it. And not to follow that group conscience and to insist that your way is the right way and no one else has the right way and that your sponsees should do what you do is a tremendous obstacle. And it's not just an obstacle because someone says, really, that's not fair. I feel as if I'm being controlled or anything of that sort. It's a real obstacle because a plan of eating that might work for you might allow me to indulge in something that causes me cravings, uncontrollable cravings. And so you're giving me permission to indulge in that which I should not be indulging in. That's a very practical danger that is not just a control issue. It's an issue that can lead to, it wouldn't even lead to relapse because you would always have been indulging in that which you should be abstaining from. That's not even a relapse. You're just indulging in it. There are other entrenched ideas. And we big book thumpers are just as guilty of these as other people are. And that is, there's only one way to work the steps. Do what the first 100 did, and you'll have what the first 100 had. And there's only one way of working it. And believe me, we're not alone. There's all kinds of people in OA who say their way of working the steps is the only way of working it. Here are the questions you have to answer in the first 30 days, the first 70 days, the first 100 days. You must do it in this order, in this way. You must do this kind of outreach. You must do this kind of thing, or I won't sponsor you. Now, there's nothing wrong with saying these are the kinds of things I did, and if you want what I had, I'm willing to tell you how I did them. But to require people to do that, to have this entrenched idea that there is only one way of doing it, and it is the way that you were taught, is a real obstacle in OA as well. Because it doesn't treat the individual as an individual. Everyone learns in different ways. Everyone responds in different ways. Everyone has their own way of dealing with things. And we have to realize that if we're going to treat everyone's plan of eating as being their plan of eating and help them develop one that works for them, even though it might not work for us, we also have to understand that people learn in different ways. People have different ways of understanding ideas. People have different ways of understanding words. And if we don't try and help them work through in their own way how they're going to learn, then we do them a disservice. So an entrenched way of, an entrenched way of working the steps is very dangerous. And similarly, an entrenched way of getting out of a relapse. It might do someone good if you relapsed to reread a paragraph a day of the doctor's opinion and to discuss it with your sponsor for 20 minutes. But for someone else, it might be counterproductive. It might be time for them to say, my God, my relapse has caused me to be even more desperate than ever. I just want to get on with the steps and get that recovery. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to do step four. I'm ready to meet with you in step five in 2 weeks. I'll get it done in a week. I'll get it done. Just let me get that recovery. If you have an entrenched way of dealing with things, if there's one size fits all, which we certainly know in OA is not true. If one size fits all, then one size fits none. And I think we have to understand that. So I think that's another obstacle in OA. And I think the last one I know does not appear so much within these particular rooms, but certainly happens in much of OA, and that is an emphasis on things other than the steps. It's missing what Tradition 5 is all about. You know, Tradition 5 is that our only purpose is to carry our message as a group, is to carry our message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. That's the primary purpose of every group. It's really the sole purpose of every group. And in our meetings, and I've been to lots and lots of meetings, we lose that. And in a way, there is this tendency to lose the steps. Let me just go back. What is our message? What is the message that our groups have to carry? It is the message of step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps. So we've had a spiritual awakening, which has come to us because we have worked the 12 steps of OA. We try to carry this message, the message that we have recovered through the 12 steps. We've got our spiritual awakening through the 12 steps to those who still suffer. And that's the message of Tradition 5. But how often do we miss that message when we reduce our program to rituals, or we reduce our program to tools, or we reduce our programs to meetings or phone calls? We miss the message of the steps if we concentrate on the rituals. And there are so many rituals. How many meetings have 20, 30 minutes of readings before you even begin the meeting? How many meetings allow people to share, I shouldn't say allow, because there should be no controls, but encourage people to share on how they're feeling rather than on what step they're on? How many meetings discuss the week or the day rather than talk about the steps? If our primary purpose is to talk about the recovery that comes from the 12 steps, then aren't we missing it if we encourage people to talk about things other than the steps? If we encourage people to go through rituals rather than working the steps? I see this all through OA. It is a tendency that I've had myself, this tendency of wanting other people to have exactly what I have and to be exactly who I was and to carry on sort of what I was taught, I'm now going to teach to you. I am not there as a sponsor. I am not there to teach anyone. I am there to give them my experience, strength, and hope, and to be as honest with them as I can about those things. But sometimes we lose that in developing rituals of phone me every day at 6 in the morning for 5 minutes. If you miss 5 you know, X number of phone calls, or if you're even late by 5 minutes, then I can't sponsor you anymore. If you relapse, I can't sponsor you. If you relapse three times, I can't sponsor you. If you don't do it this way, I can't sponsor you. This whole sense of that there are rituals and there's the steps. And if you look at the history of AA, you will see, and really the history of OA, you will see that this history consists of people doing their best to give their experience strength and hope, but treating the individual as the individual and not trying to impose on them one particular way of doing anything. The steps come down to some easy concepts that were first communicated, according to Bill, by Ebby. You get honest with yourself. You get honest with another human being. You make up for the wrongs that you've done. You trust in God. You pray to God for guidance. And you help others without hope of property, reward, or prestige. Those very simple concepts that were adopted from parts of the Oxford groups, in part from the Oxford groups, those simple concepts may have had their expression in more detail through the big book or through the various pieces of OA literature. But down deep, there is this one, these basic senses. You clean up your past and you dedicate yourself to other people. That's what you do. How you do it? Well, there are better and there are worse ways, maybe, but there are many different ways, and we have to remember that. So I think I'm almost at about the time where I can stop. I just want to go through. I think I've covered a lot of this. I think that OA to recover, for individuals to recover in OA, and for OA to grow, there has to be this sense of fundamental despair. This is life or death. It may not be dramatic, but it's life or death. There has to be this sense of utter hope. If other people have done it, I can, but you can only have hope if you know what you're hoping for. And the only way to do that is to understand this concept of I can't stop once I've started and I can't stop from starting. So the despair is I can't stop from starting, and on my own, I can't stop from starting again. That's the despair. The hope is millions and millions of people with dozens and dozens of addictions have been able to stop from starting by gaining sanity through a spiritual awakening, having a personality change sufficient to overcome their addiction. And how did they do that? They cleaned house. They cleaned house. That's steps 4 through 9, right? They were honest with themselves. They were honest with another human being, and they made up for the wrongs that they had done. They isolated their defects of character, and they made up for them. And now they try to live according to what they most deeply believe in, their own higher power, whether that's a particular kind of God or whether that's fundamental beliefs that they can't question, that are just fundamental to them. And they try their best to live according to that and to be guided by their intuitive sense that if they have cleaned up their past and they're living in the day and they're not afraid of the future, that what they ultimately believe in will come through the pipeline into their heads, and they will live and react and act in life according to the best motives, not the worst. And then they keep it by doing what I hope I've been doing in the last 45 minutes, carrying the message to others. Desperately, desperately needing to carry that message, regardless of whether anyone hears it, regardless if we don't do well in carrying it. But I have to carry the message. I must find someone to tell my message, to tell my story to, because not only in telling it do I maybe help someone else, I'm thinking of someone else rather than myself, but I also remind myself of how desperate I used to be and how I never want to go back there. I think I will stop there. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you so much, Lori, for this fascinating presentation this morning, truly compelling and thought-provoking. Thank you. The share ID for today's presentation, 22,464. That's 22464. Another gem for the archive. Thank you, Lori. Lori's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so you'll stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question-answer segment. You can pose a question, questions only, one question per person, please, by pressing star one to unmute. I need your first name as well as the first letter of your last name, please.
Margaret Dean, Georgia. Jason K. D.
On the
register
R. On the
register
R.
Gotcha. Thus far, I have a Jennifer, Margaret D., Jason K., Hanietta R. Who did I miss?
Claire B.
Claire.
Loretta H.
Loretta H.
Krista S.
Krista S.
Ginger C. from Colorado.
Ginger. Okay, let's get started with this group, please. Everybody mute except for Jennifer. Once again, questions only, one question only per person, please. Thank you. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much, Lori. Very clear, very, very good teaching. My question is in regards to step 10. I know that you said this is not a one-size-fits-all, so I'm just very curious if you can elaborate on how you guide your sponsees and other fellows to embrace the 10 step. Thank you so much.
Well, this is a thank you for asking. This is a very favorite question of mine because not understanding step 10 led to many of my relapses in the first 7 years in the fellowship. And doing the step 10 as I've been taught has kept me from relapse for the last 32 years. There is a difference, as I see it, between step 10 in the big book and step 11, the evening meditation in the big book. Even though in the AA 12 and 12 and in our OA 12 and 12, there's a conflation of the two. Let me take the step 11. The step 11 meditation, evening meditation, as it's called in the big book, is a review of the day that has just passed. How did we do today? And many of the defects of character that were isolated in step four are mentioned, and talking to someone else is mentioned, and making up for the harms that we've done. But it is just the day. That's how I read it. How did I do today? How did I conduct myself? Were there elements of my defects of character that interfered with how I conducted myself today? Very often these days, I'm pleased to say my answer is no. I acted without self-will, I acted honestly, I acted without self-seeking, and I acted without fear. And that stops my meditation. Today I did well. Tomorrow I may not. The day before I may not have, but today it was okay. But step 10, I've been taught, and I learned this through bitter experience, is a catch-up on all that has happened in my life since the last time I did step 10 or steps 4 through 9. There's a past. Whether it's a week old or it's a year old, there is a past. And if that past begins to rear its ugly head, if I begin to live with ideas, people, ideas, principles, and institutions begin to live rent-free in my mind again, then it's time for me to do what I did in step 4 through 9, to write out my resentments, to figure out my fears, to look at my relationship issues, to share that with another human being, say the step 7 prayer as quickly as I can and get right on to my amends, which are usually these days adjustments in my reaction to life and sometimes adjustments in my actions in life, and certainly a readjustment of my thinking to concentrate on others instead of being full of self-pity or fear. My experience has been that when I have had sponsees who relapse, often it's been step 10 that has been their downfall. They have not realized how much things had been building up in them. I can give you some examples if it'll help very quickly. There have been there are too many examples I can think of, but every day when my mother was ill for she was ill for over a number of 3 or 4 years, I would review my day to see how I did that day with my parents. Did I give them love? Did I visit them? Did I talk to them on the phone? Did I try and lift their spirits up? Did I do anything to ease whatever burdens they had? But every week, for quite some time, I would do a step 10 on my mother and my father, and discover, and because it was an ongoing difficult situation, so that it wasn't just every day. It was gradually my loss of the mother that I used to have, the burden that was on my father. These were weighing on me, and I had to write them down as resentments. I had to figure out what kind of a person I had to be in relation to that, what my defects of character were. So there was a big difference. And, you know, there is in the Big Book workbook that is available now, which it was a collaborative effort of many, many Big Book thumpers on how to understand the Big Book for OA members. There is in there sort of like a 12-point list that's taken from restless, irritable, and discontented in the doctor's opinion, to the 8 bedevilments found on, I think it's page 52 of the of We Agnostics. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We felt we were not of use to anyone. We're having financial problems. And whether food is becoming more of an issue. If any of those things happen, it's time to relook at life. And we live in a world right now in which there's polarization, fear of the future, anger, resentment. Things are bombarding us. No matter what our political persuasion, we're being bombarded by things that bother us. And if we don't, at a certain point, and this is what I do for step 10, step back and write all those things down and figure out where our self-will is involved and our dishonesty and our self-seeking and our fears, and deal with all the fears relating to the future of the world and what's going to happen and all that. If we don't do that in the organized way that we learn to do it in steps 4 through 9, then we're in danger of relapse, simply because our resentments will overpower our mind, and our mind will give us permission to return to that which we know we should abstain from. Does that answer your question? Hope it does.
Let's take that as a yes. Okay, moving on to Margaret. Margaret D., your turn.
Thank you, Laura. Yes, that is an absolute yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. Margaret.
Hey, good morning. And thank you so much for all the energy that you put into to all of this. So keeping in mind the idea or the concept of paradoxes, how does one navigate from there's many ways to work a program to working the steps according to how they're like written or how they're, you know, presented, how I don't know if that makes sense, but that's my question.
All right. I do understand. And I just have to say this, that there's an old joke that might assist in understanding this, of a mathematics professor who writes a very complicated formula on the blackboard, fills up the whole blackboard, and he says to his class, or they say to their class, well, from this, it's absolutely just a minute, he said. I'll be back. And he goes away for 20 minutes. He comes back and says, I was right. It's obvious. And this whole concept of it's the plain meaning of the words is belied by the reality that it took me 7 years to understand what the Big Book's directions were, even though I read it all the time. And so I had to be guided. I had to be taught what the Big Book's directions were, but it's only an interpretation because I sure didn't see it until someone helped me understand it. The steps are the steps. They are boiled down to some very basic fundamental ideas. There are many ways of working them. Dr. Bob works step 4 differently from the way Bill works step 4, differently from the way Clarence works step 4. I have many friends in this fellowship who are my absolute idols. I look up to them. They're more spiritual than I am. They their stories are stories of despair, much greater than I had, terrible childhoods that I did not have. I had a great childhood. And they work the steps in a way different from the way I work the steps. And they have recovered, and they carry their message. And I have absolutely no right to say that my way of working the steps is better than their way of working the steps. Their way of working the steps work for them. My way of working the steps work for me. So when I sponsor, I will say to people, this is my experience. And very often they come to me because I do the big book approach. But if someone said to me, you know, I'd like to try some other way of doing step four, or I want to try this, or I want to try that, I'll do that with them. Because if we learn anything from the 12 steps, it is that we can learn from our mistakes and make up for the mistakes we've made. In a way, we're lucky that our addiction is a long-term addiction, that it's a gradual descent, because we can learn from the mistakes we've made and not do complete damage to our bodies by trying something new. So I will often say to people, this is what I've been taught, but if you want to try something different, we can. Let's hope it works, and I'll do it with all I can. So it's not a matter of reconciling. There are many different ways of doing the steps. I must acknowledge that because it is a fact. You know, I happen to think that the big book approach is more easy to understand to most people and yields the best results for most people. That's been my experience, but my experience is limited to people who ask me to work the 12 steps with them. But I have so many friends who are so amazing who don't do it that way. And it's not up to me to tell them that they're wrong. I don't know if that answers your question, but what's pretty simple about the 12 steps is the essence. You get honest with yourself. You get honest with another human being. You make up for the wrongs that you've done. You help other people without hope of reward, property, or prestige. And you pray to whatever you believe in for guidance in your actions on a day-to-day basis. I think those are pretty essential. And how you do that? Well, as you recover, I'm not going to say that you did it wrong. So,
thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Margaret D. Jason K. had the same question, so he asked to be removed from the list. Hanayeta R., your turn to pose a question. Hanayeta R., your turn. Star one to unmute.
I was chatting away. Sorry. Thank you, Leia, for all of what you do for us. And thank you, Lori, for your fantastic, brilliant talk. This is the first time I've heard you in real time. I've only listened to your podcast before. What a nice pleasure. You mentioned that you don't use sugar and salt and fat and salt, which me too. But you didn't mention flour. And I was wondering, is that because you are able to eat flour in your program?
If I were celiac, I couldn't eat flour. If I mix flour with fat and sugar or fat and salt, I can't eat the fat and salt or the fat and sugar in it. But I have rarely met people. I have met some who, let's take the simplest example of pasta, which in the simplest form is flour and water. Simple boiled pasta with nothing on it. If you are addicted to that, then it might be the flour, but it might also be the texture. But I have rarely met a person, I have met some, who doesn't identify the things that they develop cravings with, that they identify with flour, that doesn't have fat and sugar or fat and salt in it. Rarely. People say, oh, it's pasta. I'm addicted to pasta. And I say, is it what you put on the pasta? Or is it the pasta itself? Some people will say it's the pasta itself, but very few. Most of them will say it's what I put on. It's the Alfredo sauce. It's the cheese. It's the oil. It's the butter that I put on. In which case, I would say that's fat and salt. I eat things made with flour. No, I don't happen to think that white flour is a particularly nutritious thing to eat. So I avoid it as much as possible. I go for whole grains just because I have a limited number of calories I can take in to maintain my body weight, and I sure don't want to waste it on non-nutritional stuff. But I'm not addicted to flour. And I challenge most people who think they're addicted to flour to look carefully at what it is that they think they're addicted to and whether that also contains a lot of fat or a lot of sugar or a lot of salt or something of that sort. You know, if you look at the Roseanne in her history of OA, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, has a whole chapter on plans, on different plans, on the different food concepts. And the flour thing was sort of put in by one person. If you look at the history, but that person also eliminated fat. And I know too many people in OA who have clearly not reached a healthy body weight who say, "Oh, I can't have the buns at meal, but we'll put the butter and the sour cream and the bacon bits on their huge baked potato." Saying, "Well, I'm abstinent because I'm not eating flour." So that's my answer about flour. And yes, there are some people who might be addicted. I've never met a person who could eat a bag of flour. But let's say you mix it with water just to make it edible. I've met some people who have been addicted to pasta, pure and simple. But those are few and far between. And even then, I think I suspect it's the texture, it's the mouth feel that pasta has. There is this comforting feeling in the mouth. So I may be provocative, but that's my opinion. Well, that's my experience, not my opinion. It's my experience. I eat flour.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fanayeta R. Next up, Claire D.
Hello, this is Claire B. from North Carolina. Thank you so much. My question continues on from the last one, and that is, how do you approach people who come to you, because you say it's such an important part of the program, with figuring out their food plan? And when they say, "Oh, I could overeat anything," or "I am addicted to flour and sugar," because they hear people in the meetings talk about that, how do you get them to look at themselves honestly? What leading questions do you ask to help them figure that out? Thank you.
Well, it might help that I was a lawyer for many years, and I did have some experience in cross-examination. But I don't ask leading questions. I'm most concerned with is how honest they are with themselves and how willing they are to be open to the idea that maybe they've made a mistake, because they should be open, as I am always open, that maybe there's some foods I shouldn't be eating, or that maybe I've excluded some foods that I don't have to exclude. I start off with this whole sense of flexibility. But I ask them, I suggest to them that they separate the idea between a diet and a plan of eating. Plan of eating is what OA calls the way in which we abstain from compulsive eating and compulsive eating and working our way toward working to or maintaining a healthy body weight. That's the definition of abstinence. That's what a plan of eating does. That's very different from a diet. I happen to be vegan. I've adopted a vegan lifestyle for reasons that have very little to do with OA. When I was carnivorous, I was still abstinent. Being vegan makes it a little bit easier for me because dairy fats are one of my particular addictions. Butter has always been a real problem for me, and cream too. But I open the door. I don't say you're wrong. They may be right. Maybe they are addicted to flour. Maybe they are. I don't know. But I say, put aside what other people are telling you. Look carefully at the times in which you ate uncontrollably, in which you put things into your body and you said to yourself, "I must stop. I must stop. This is wrong." Or in which you indulge in eating behaviors in which you were saying to yourself, "This is bad for me. This is wrong for me." But you couldn't stop indulging them because of course, people who vomit or people who restrict our indulgent eating behaviors. I also leave the idea, some people, I think my first sponsor suffered from a binge eating problem. He just ate everything without moderation to the point of being stuffed. And what he said was, he told me that that's what I should be doing, which was a mistake because I had certain foods and certain behaviors in addition to that that I had to abstain from. I didn't know that. One of the causes of my relapses over the first 7 years in the fellowship. But I just ask people to be as honest as they can, and I ask them questions, but what about that? If they come to me with flour, my response will be to do what I just did in my earlier answer to the question. Is it really flour, or is it what you put on the stuff that has flour in it? If they say my nutritionist gave me this program, this diet, I will say, okay, what within that diet has caused you in the past uncontrollable cravings? So I just ask questions like that. I bring it back to this concept of uncontrollable cravings, and that really opens the door to, well, what part of it? What do you see anything that's common to that? You know, I began my journey of recovery over 32 years ago with a fellow who had come from AA and who had really studied the Big Book, whose binge foods were fast foods. That was it. That's what he identified as things he had to abstain from. He couldn't go to any fast food place and order anything from those places. He lost a lot of weight. That did the job for him for quite some time. And so I just ask questions. I just sort of say, well, what about this or what about that? Or, you know, is it the pasta or what you put on the pasta? Is it the bread or what you put on the bread? Is it all breads or just some breads? You know, there's a big difference between the cakey bread the challah that my grandmother and grandfather used to buy every week and smear butter on, the big difference between that cakey bread and the German flatbreads, you know, the very thick things that are mostly seeds and whole grains. Is it all breads or just some breads? Let's get more specific. Let's look for common ingredients. And also let's look for eating behaviors. Because you may have only one problem, a particular eating behavior. You may have only one substance, sugar, flour, fat, I don't know. Or you may have a combination of substances or a combination of ingredients or a combination of eating behaviors. Just open the minds to the possibility, because what's most important is that they are honest with themselves, not that they're honest with me. So I just ask people to put aside the difference between a diet and a plan of eating. Although I'm vegan, there are a lot of vegan foods I can't eat because they're so full of fat that I can't eat them. They will cause cravings in me. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Claire B. Loretta H., your question, please.
Leah, thank you very, very much for your service. And Lori, you know, you always, always share something that is just puts a lot of information on my path, but also a lot of hope. So you, and I may misunderstand because I have old ears, and that I do not give out food plans to anybody. I send them to a professional. And I don't take food because I don't know how to eat. And my first sponsor was a nutritionist. So if I, and I take a lot of people that have relapsed through the steps, and my thing is I actually, if they and the nutritionist are on some sort of plan to talk to each other and she or he explains their eating behaviors and eating plans to them, and they believe, and that's the only thing I, like you said, rigorous honesty, and my primary purpose is to help the sick and suffering, that I must believe, and then I take them immediately through the steps, even though I have no knowledge of how they eat. Am I doing them a disservice?
I don't see how, if it works. I mean, I know you put a whole bunch of little ifs in there, which I agree with absolutely. If the nutritionist understands the concept of cravings, if the nutritionist is told of what the behavior issues might be, if the nutritionist is told of what some of the ingredients might be a problem, and then develops a plan of eating, taking all those things into account, it makes some sense. Because then the way that you abstain is you're given certain things that you measure and measure or weigh that are nutritionally sound for you, that give you the number of calories that you need to lose weight or to gain weight, depending on the person, and still be nutritionally sound so that you're getting all the vitamins and minerals and et cetera that you need, fiber that you need. I like to examine them nonetheless, just because I'm not sure I, on a personal level, my experience has been, and one of my friends in OA was trained as a nutritionist, is that a lot of nutritionists aren't told a lot about the concept of craving and aren't told a lot about the concept of certain ingredients or certain foods should be on a no-no list. You know, when I meet people from eating disorder clinics who are told, you know, they were anorexic, they're bulimic, they must eat everything on their plate. They must eat ice cream. They must eat cookies and stuff like that. I really wonder about that. It may apply to many people with eating disorders, but it may not apply to a person who suffers from cravings when they eat things with a lot of fat in them or with a lot of sugar in them or both. So I don't know if you're doing a disservice. As long as people are honest with themselves, that's fine. When and if they relapse, then I will say, well, there are two reasons for relapse. One is that you're still eating something or indulging in an eating behavior that you should be abstaining from. And let's look back at your plan of eating to see whether there's anything that might have caused that relapse from a purely, if you will, a physical level, a craving level. And then I say, well, let's work this, you know, let's get the steps right this time or something like that. But no, I mean, I question people more, but it's certainly, if it works, it works. This is a practical program. It's not, there's no rules here. And the way I do things might not be as good as the way other people do things. So no one should treat me as an expert on anything.
Thank you, Loretta, for your question. Krista S., your turn.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for your service. It was awesome. So my question is about sponsorship. In the big book, they don't use the word sponsor, I don't believe, and I've gone through many, 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 many sponsors who, you know, had really good points about them, but also a lot of suggestions that were not in the big book, and a lot of opinions about things in my life that were not food-related. And sometimes I find it more harmful than helpful. Do you have any opinions on sponsorship? Do you need a sponsor? Is it possible to go through the book just using the fellowship without a sponsor? How do you find a good sponsor, et cetera? Thank you.
The answer is pretty clear that you don't need a sponsor to work the steps, although a sponsor can be extremely helpful. The big book was written for people who didn't have sponsors in their lives, and the directions in the big book can be used very clearly can be used if you don't have a sponsor. My recovery stems from working with another non-recovered compulsive eater. Both of us were having problems. We worked together, and each of us recovered using the directions that we found in the big book. So that's a simple answer. The other thing is, we have to carry our message. Once we recover, we got to carry our message to someone, and sponsoring is one of the best ways of doing that. So it is good to have a sponsor, and I don't want to put myself out of a job in sponsoring by saying you don't need a sponsor. You don't need a sponsor, but a sponsor can be very helpful. The danger of sponsorship is when people try to be in charge, not necessarily because they're controlling, but it could be partly that, but it's also because they have a ritual that they've been taught works, and they work the ritual. And they say, if I'm going to sponsor you, you have to do the ritual. You have to do it this way. You have to have this kind of plan of eating. You must do that. There's a very controlling aspect to it there may not be an individual control issue, but maybe part of their way of doing things. And there are some fellowships where the sponsor decides whether you can go on trips or not or take medications, which is terrible, I think, just on a personal level. So, I mean, the big book says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every person, man, they say, wife or no wife, God or job or no job, you do not recover so long as you place your dependence upon another person rather than your dependence upon God. And I take that very seriously. My job as a sponsor is to give experience, strength, and hope, to help, to advise, to suggest, but never to judge, never to do anything other than say, my job is to help you work the steps if you want me to help you work the steps. I'm not going to tell you how to do them. I'm going to tell you what I did. I'm going to tell you what I've learned. If that helps you, terrific. If not, you know, that's fine. So you don't need a sponsor, but boy, a sponsor can be helpful if they are open, flexible, and willing to help, and humble. Because remember, the big book says, actually, he may be helping you more than you may be helping him. And I am so grateful for the opportunity to sponsor. Now, I set very clear boundaries for the kind of sponsorship I do. You know, I don't want people to phone me every day. I don't want people to phone me every week. I will meet with them when it's time to talk about a step or to do a step which requires another human being, like step 5 or maybe steps 8 and 9 to discuss issues, or to do step 3, say the step 3 prayer. But I don't meet on a regular basis because if they need support, they should get it from someone who could use the support themselves. I say, if in order to stay abstinent while you're working the steps, you need to have daily contact. You need to commit your food. You need to do this. Go with someone who's not recovered. That'll be good for them as well as for yourself. You'll be having daily contact with someone who could use daily contact. But don't do it with me. I don't have the time. I don't have the, nor am I sympathetic to it. You know, my job is to help you work the steps, not to be your support person. And if anyone, Leah will give my email address after this, but I'm willing, I have a template of how I sponsor, that I send out to people who ask me to sponsor them. And I'd be happy to send that template to anyone if they just want to get a sense of how to set the limits so that you're not in charge of the other person, but they know what you're there for. I'll be happy to do that. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Krista. And our final question this morning comes from Ginger C.
Good morning, Leah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Leah, and Vision for you, and another beautiful experience, strength, and hope, Lori. And I really appreciate hearing you say about the dangers of sharing food plans. I think that is very important. And my question for someone who is chronically relapsing, returning to that first bite that they know is going to absolutely take them to hell, why do they? I've heard that this is a step one issue. I don't know if it's a desperation. You've mentioned that in your talk. But many, I think more, that's their experience, and they sadly don't even get any recovery ever while they're here in this life. They don't get there. They don't stay stopped. And I don't know if you have any feelings around that, but I would love to hear.
Plenty. I do have lots of feelings about that. I mean, I feel so sad for them. But I go back to the realities and the analysis of the program. The first question is your plan of eating right for you? Maybe you are giving yourself the ability through your plan of eating to indulge in things that you shouldn't be indulging in. That's the first question right off the bat. You must be open to that. Are there some foods that you're eating that you shouldn't be eating? Are there some ingredients you're indulging in that you shouldn't be indulging in? Are there eating behaviors you're indulging in that you shouldn't be indulging in? Because they might be the secret cause of your cravings. Once you give up the obvious ones, sometimes you discover new ones that have taken their place. That certainly happened to me after 6 months of being abstinent from fat and sugar and fat and salt. I discovered I had eating behaviors I also had to abstain from because I wasn't losing any weight. But I had achieved recovery. So that's the first thing. Second is, what I do for people who've relapsed is I try to get them back working the steps as quickly as possible. I will say, are you more desperate than ever? Let's make an appointment right now for step five. Let's say the step four prayer, step three prayer. Let's get you right on to step four. And what is your strategy for avoiding temptation in the next 2 weeks while you're working step four? Are you going to phone someone every day? Are you going to commit your food? Are you going to make sure you don't pass by any drive-thrus? Are you going to throw everything out of your house that might be a problem for you? Are you not going to go to any parties or any events where food might be served? What are you going to do to keep abstinent until you finish step five? Because, of course, as you know, when the big book, from the big book perspective, once you finish step five, within a day, you're halfway through step nine. And so that you will achieve the miracle so quickly right after step five, that we got to get you to step five as quickly as possible. So that's what I say. Now, it doesn't work with everyone. A lot of people are living in a world of their own. They're living in their own prison. And, you know, what the big book says, some people do not have the capacity to be rigorously honest. I just continue to repeat these things, and ultimately they fire me. I've never fired anyone, but I get fired because I'm not there to listen to their problems. I'm there to give them the solutions that have been so freely given to me. I hope that helps a bit.
Thank you, Ginger C. Thank you so much, Lori, for your time and this beautiful presentation this morning. Informative, riveting, as always. Thank you. Again, the share ID for today, 22,464. That's 22464. We're going to close now from page 164. It's found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.